talking with Scott, he had to endure a caller during the break, a woman who was calling to complain, actually not on our show, but on a different show that was mocking the idea that parents, when they noticed that their children were viewing porn, called the police. Now, I want to tell you, viewing porn is not illegal. The police are supposed to be involved in stopping illegal activity. While porn is not a good idea, that is a parent's responsibility. It is not a police responsibility. So they were laughing at the parents and mocking them, and rightfully so. That's not the proper response. Now, the other reality is that there probably isn't 5% of male children, nor more than 10% of female children in this country who haven't at one time or another viewed porn. It's that prevalent. And they have so many devices from which to view it, from their smartphones to their iPads to their laptops to their home computers, as well as television sets, to attempt to prevent a child from viewing porn is almost impossible. So what you can do is counsel them and say, you know, this is not something that you want to develop an addiction to, not something that we would encourage you to do. It has a very perverted view of sex, and that sex is a marvelous thing, but it should be done between two individuals who are in love with one another and in the ultimately moving towards a monogamous relationship in marriage. But there is this legacy, I think, of Pauline Christianity, which is so hypocritical. Paul admits that he was a sexual pervert. And yet Paul has this overriding fixation on all forms of pornography and fornication that really don't materialize anyplace else. I mean, Yahweh has issues. He says, I don't want you to commit bestiality. I don't want you to commit incest. You know, I don't want you to engage in homosexuality. Denver says, I don't want you to ever look upon someone who is engaged in these things. But the suggestion is strongly there, because there's two places where someone participated in acts of incest and that were viewed by others, which is almost implying encouraged by others, that God speaks very harshly against. But the fact is, folks, that pornography is not a crime. It's a bad idea. But when talk show hosts mock parents who call the police on such a thing, they're in their right to do so. And so the listeners to programs ought not jump on their high horse and say that is an inappropriate thing to do. The fact is that the real God created us to be one as husband and wife in marriage through a sexual union. And the covenant, the signature of the covenant is a slice on the most used part of the male anatomy relative to sexual sensation and procreation. God's not opposed to sex. He invented it. And he has very little to say apart from the corruptions of bestiality and incest and pedophilia about human sexuality. He has a lot more to say about things that are vastly more important. For example, talking to your children about the Torah, about the covenant, about Yahweh's fatherly advice as to how we can maximize our lives. And we, as a population, have had this tendency to get tied up in our own underwear over our own pet peeves. This woman's pet peeve was pornography. Others, it's homosexuality. Some, it's abortion. Some, it's hate speech. Whatever it might be. You know, some are, their whole worldview is that of patriotism. Others, it's Republican or Democratic politics. Everybody seems to have galvanized to an opinion that they will cling to beyond all else. And Yahweh's view is, open up your eyes. Open up your ears. Open up your mind. Take a really good and close look at the world before you, and particularly at my testimony. And consider what I have to say. And then, use your good judgment that I gave you. Exercise good judgment to determine how to best respond to what I'm offering. He doesn't say close your eyes. He doesn't say run and hide. He doesn't say that many of these things that people are focused on, preoccupied on, are should be the focus of our attention. No, he's really focused on, I've provided good guidance to you in my Torah, in my prophets and Psalms. I've proven that I inspired these texts so that you can trust me. I have demonstrated that I am trustworthy, myself willing to do everything that's necessary to save you, providing you all the information you need to live a more productive life and to engage in the eternal covenant relationship with me, be part of my family. It would be a much wiser use of that woman's time and of most of our listeners' time to focus on what God has to say rather than to rant at someone mocking stupid behavior. Yeah, well, the Most High is good. He is always right and completely correct, consistently straightforward. Therefore, he is the source of teaching and instruction, and he guides and directs sinners along the way. This statement from a Psalm 25:8 tells us not only that Yahweh's focus is his teaching, which is what Torah means. This is the verb yara, which is the basis of Torah. But that his instructions, his guidance, aren't delineated for perfect people, but for sinners. It's delineated to those who on occasion, venture into sexual promiscuity that isn't healthy. We're flawed. His teaching, his guidance is for those of us who have erred. It's not for perfect people. What good would guidance be to perfect people? Why would God even bother to provide instructions to perfect people? They're already perfect. Except it would also be meaningless beyond the fact that perfect people wouldn't need guidance. But beyond that, there are no perfect people. God created us so that we would have our unique proclivities and then came up with a plan for the imperfect. His guidance is for those of us who are not perfect. This, by the way, completely destroys the basis of Pauline Christianity, this notion that the Torah can only save if you abide by everything the Torah says, but if you fail in any one of the Torah's instructions and it's impossible to keep, that you're condemned by it. Yahweh's testimony regarding his Torah is exactly the opposite of that. He says that his guidance is for the flawed, for the imperfect, for sinners, and for us who are imperfect along the way. That's what it tells us to do. There is a way, only one way. It's the way. Begins with the doorway of Passover, over the threshold of perfection, which is unyeasted bread, and into the company of Yahweh's family through the adoption process that is firstborn children, so that we're enriched and empowered by Shavuah, the promise of the Shabbat. This psalm, composed by Dodd, continues with, "He enables the way of the unpretentious and sincere, who respond and actively engage. With this means to exercise good judgment and achieve justice by resolving disputes. He provides the information to teach those who respond to his call and act upon his way." You see, the guidance only benefits those who respond to it. You don't benefit from your father's instructions unless you pay attention and act accordingly. It doesn't mean that your father's instructions are a set of laws. It means that he is providing guidance that if you acknowledge, if you accept, will steer you in the right direction. Well, the difference is that our Heavenly Father's guidance is absolute perfect. And so if you are unpretentious, if you're sincere, and you listen to what he has to say and respond, then his instructions are for you. They will benefit you. They will enable you to exercise good judgment and find that your disputes with Yahweh, your mishpat, are resolved. That's the purpose of this instruction. He provides the information that teach us so that we can respond to his invitation and act upon his way. His way is the Moed Mikre. They facilitate the benefits of the covenant. And his Torah, which presents this covenant, this way, exists to teach us what we need to know so that we can exercise good judgment and respond to Yahweh's offer. All the mannerisms and conduct of Yahweh are merciful and beyond reproach. They're loving, generous, and they are trustworthy and reliable for those who are preserved by his family-oriented covenant relationship and his enduring witness and restoring testimony. Yahweh's actions are always appropriate. They're always trustworthy, always reliable. He is merciful. He is beyond reproach. It's too bad there's the most popular religion in the world that says exactly the opposite. When Dodd writes about the mannerisms and conduct of Yahweh and saying that they are merciful, loving, beyond reproach, and trustworthy and reliable, he's speaking of Yahweh engaging in our world. And he's not, I mean, while he affirms that the testimony of Yahweh is merciful and beyond reproach, but he's saying here specifically that the conduct of Yahweh, the actions of Yahweh. So you have to think, okay, how did Yahweh act? Well, he acted to create the universe, the physical, material world. So the Gnostic threads that run through Pauline Christianity are negated because God created the material world and said it's beyond reproach, trustworthy, and reliable, unlike the Gnostic position that the flesh is bad and the spirit is good. That's wholly destroyed by this statement. You have God and Pauline Christians on the opposite side of this equation. But it also means that Yahweh himself engaged in our world, the world that we live in. So how did he do that? Well, he engaged in the garden with Adam, demonstrating what it would be like to camp out with God for all time. He acted in pronouncing the sentences for those who chose not to listen to what he had to say at the end of the stay in the garden. And he's saying these sentences that he handed out were therefore appropriate, actually merciful. They have a consequence. Because if there was no consequence for separating oneself from God, from ignoring his testimony, then there couldn't be a benefit associated with paying attention to what he had to say. If corrupting his testimony has no consequence, then why bother to listen to what he has to say? You know, he engaged with the flood to eliminate those humans with the Nesama who were filling the earth with violence. He will do so again. He's promised to return at a time where if he did not cut that time short, there would be no life left. That humanity would simply annihilate oneself and the planet. But the most important intervention was when Yahweh engaged to draw his children out of the political and religious realm of Egypt toward the promised land. And then, when he came in year 4000 Yah to fulfill the first four of his Moed Mikre, Passover, unyeasted bread, firstborn children, and the promise of seven. It was his willingness himself, not as the second or third person in a trinity, but he himself engaging in our world as the Passover lamb, as the soul that paid the penalty for our rebellion, our sin, to be the first of the firstborn into the covenant family, leading the way, demonstrating what we will be like in eternity, and facilitating the enrichment and empowerment of Shavuah, of the promise of the Shabbat. That's how Yahweh engaged. We ought to pay attention to what he did. We ought to recognize that what he did in fulfilling those promises relative to the covenant provides mercy. They're beyond reproach. They are trustworthy and reliable. And yet, less than 1 in 1 million people acknowledges his role in this regard. Christians say that it was a Jesus Christ who did these things, and they don't even associate them with the events they themselves fulfilled. They don't know and understand that he enabled the promises of Passover, unyeasted bread, firstborn children, and the promise of seven. They don't know that. They don't know his name. They don't know who it was. And therefore, while God's actions were merciful, while his fulfillments are trustworthy and reliable, they're only so for those who are preserved by the family-oriented covenant relationship. This is an affirmation of something that I've shared so many times on this program, that only the covenant's children are saved. Only the covenant's children engage in a relationship with God. If you're not part of the covenant, you do not know him, and you are not saved by him. That's what this statement says, so we can trust it. Welcome back to Shattering This. The covenant is, by this statement, directly associated with the benefits offered through Yahweh's conduct. So Yahweh's conduct, where he engaged in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE, fulfilling the promises that he had made to the covenant's children to make us immortal, to make us perfect, to adopt us into his family, to enrich us and to empower us. That's the conduct of Yahweh in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE, on those specific dates of Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah. And this statement says that those actions of Yahweh are merciful. They are worthy of our trust. They are reliable for the stated purpose. For those who are preserved by, who are observant of, Natsar, the family-oriented covenant relationship, the Berith, and his enduring witness and restoring testimony. The fact that his covenant and his enduring witness and restoring testimony are linked is as it should be. The fact that Yah's actions are linked to the benefits of the covenant is as it should be. The fact that Yahweh's conduct is viewed as merciful, trustworthy, and reliable for those who are engaged in the covenant is as it should be. The covenant can be acted upon. It can be known about. It can be benefited from. It can be entered in only one place. The enduring witness and restoring testimony, the Edah of Yahweh, which is comprised of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. There you will find an eyewitness account prophetically presented of Yahweh's conduct in year 4000 Yah. It begins actually in the first book of Bereshith, where Yahweh speaks of what he is going to do with the greater light becoming visible as a sign of the Moed in the fourth day of creation, year 4000 Yah. He did exactly what he promised. And he outlines the importance of and his role in Passover, unyeasted bread, matzah, and bukurim, and shavuah, throughout his Torah, his prophets, and his Psalms. This is a universal statement. Mizmor Psalm 25:10. It is the antidote for Christianity, the antidote for Judaism, the antidote for socialist secular humanism. It is a very clear statement of fact, particularly when read in conjunction with what precedes it and what follows it. So let's read the Psalm 25, 8, 9, and 10, and then move on to 11. Yahweh, the Most High, God, is good. He's always right, completely correct, and consistently straightforward. Therefore, he is the source of teaching and instruction, and he guides and directs sinners along the way. He enables the way of the unpretentious and sincere who respond and actively engage. With this means to exercise good judgments and achieve justice by resolving disputes. He provides the information to teach those who respond to his call and act upon it his way. All of the mannerisms and conduct of Yahweh are merciful and beyond reproach. They are trustworthy and reliable for those who are preserved by those who observe his family-oriented covenant relationship and his enduring witness and restoring testimony. As a result of your name, Yahweh, you will choose to genuinely and completely forgive my sin, which is great, the Dod says. Now consider this man. Yahweh acknowledges that Dod, who was an imperfect individual, a sinner, was completely forgiven. Yahweh calls him Tzedak, righteous, vindicated, upright. And yet he was a sinner. How was he forgiven then? Because of Yahweh's conduct. Because of Yahweh's testimony. As a result of the covenant relationship. And as a result of his name. Because his name shows two people standing, protected in the tent of the witness by the tent pegs that expand it and make it secure. Two people standing because they've reached up and grasped hold of his hand. That's how Yahweh was written in Paleo-Hebrew. There's an open hand reaching out and down to those who observe what he has to say, who reach up and grasp hold of it. That's his name. That's what his name conveys. It is through his name that he forgives our sin, which is great. So if you do not know his name, and there isn't one Christian in a million that does, if you do not celebrate his name, if you do not greet him by name, if you do not know him by name, then your sin, which is great, remains. And you are estranged from God. Yahweh has a name, and his name is essential to salvation, just as his conduct in fulfilling the Moed Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shabuah, is essential, just as his testimony, the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, is essential, just as participation in the covenant is essential. But should you pay attention to his testimony? Should you act upon his covenant? Should you embrace the means that he has provided to resolve disputes? Should you be receptive to him? Should you know what he has done when he engaged in our world to facilitate a merciful solution? Should you do these things and know him by name, then you are a beneficiary of all that he has to offer. Hence, Dod writes, whatever individual respects and reveres Yahweh, he will teach and guide him in the way he should choose. What's the prerequisite? Respecting and revering Yahweh. If you're a Christian, that is not the case. If you're a Christian, your admiration is for a mythological creation based upon the Gnosticism and the cult of Dionysus. That's your Jesus Christ. If you're a Christian, you disdain the Torah. You disdain the invitations to meet with God, Passover, unleavened bread, firstborn children, and the promise of seven. You hate them. You think that there's something that has been done away with and annulled, and that participation in them makes you one of those horrible Jews. You hate God's actions. You despise his Torah. You think that his Torah, based upon Pauline doctrine, enslaves, that it's pornographic, that it has no capacity to save, that it was a hindrance to humankind. Your view is the antithesis of the view that matters. Rather than using Yahweh's name, embracing his name, celebrating his name, you condemn those who use it. So it's only those individuals who respect and revere Yahweh that are receptive to his teaching and guidance, that act upon the way that he has provided, that make the right choice. Those individuals, his soul, in the most favorable, pleasing, and festival circumstances, will dwell and endure, and his descendants will inherit the realm, the nature of the covenant. When you act upon the five terms and conditions of the covenant, you receive the benefits of the covenant. The benefits of the covenant is to have our soul, not our physical bodies, our souls, exist in the most favorable, pleasing, and festive of circumstances, Tob, and that which is good, beautiful, prosperous, and enjoyable, dwelling and enduring forever, as well as our descendants, inheriting the realm. As God's children, we inherit all that he has to give. That's the purpose of the covenant. A very close and intimate fellowship with Yahweh is certain for those who respect and revere him. And his family-oriented covenant relationship he makes known to them. The covenant and intimacy with God are inseparable. If you're not a participant in the covenant, and there's only one, it has not yet been renewed, which negates the entirety of the Christian New Testament. If you are not a participant in the covenant according to its terms and conditions, as they are delineated in the opening book of the Torah, then you are not in an intimate fellowship with God. You're estranged from him. You don't even know him. He does not know you. Because a very close and intimate fellowship with Yahweh is only certain for those who respect and revere him and his family-oriented covenant relationship. Pauline Christianity is based upon negating the old covenant, about calling the old covenant of the flesh, of dismissing it, of debasing it, of criticizing it, and of replacing it with a New Testament based upon a gospel of faith in grace. Wholly different concepts. One, the covenant of the Torah that God says is perfect, saving, enlightening, enriching, generating an eternal and intimate relationship with Yahweh, whereby his children inherit everything that he has to give, whereby his actions on our behalf are wholly reliable, dependable, trustworthy, restoring. The other, saying that none of that is true. That one man came up with this scheme that you should and must reject all of that to believe him instead. That's where you are if you're a Christian. You're out on a limb with Paul. A limb not grounded in Yah's testimony. It's really a simple proposition. Yahweh's testimony introduces us to Yahweh and to his covenant, as well as to his plan as to how he's going to engage to be merciful to us to resolve our sin. The plan is presented in the Torah. There are conditions to participate in the covenant. There are benefits of the covenant. The way that Yahweh has outlined is presented historically in the Torah and then presented in terms of its symbolic value, and how to observe those days and celebrate them and benefit from them. All of it's presented right there. We're introduced to God. He proves his authorship. He demonstrates what he's attempting to achieve. He outlines what he's offering. He provides his fatherly advice. He delineates the terms and conditions of the covenant. He states the benefits of participating in that covenant and provides guidance that is reliable. It's all there. It's all simple. Not any more complicated than that. And yet all the religions of the world lead people away from that. Christianity most certainly does. It's nothing that I've just said is ever stated in Christianity. In fact, they think that their Jesus Christ, a person unknown to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, saved them from Yahweh's testimony in his Torah. So, what do you have? You've got a religion that claims that the Torah was inspired by God, that attacks and demeans that same Torah, negates it. I mean, if you're even 1% rational, you'd have to know that that's an impossibility. It doesn't take a great intellect. It just takes an open mind to recognize that Paul's contrarian view cannot be true. Even if Yahweh's Torah was incapable of saving us, Pauline Christianity is irrefutably false. And so denouncing it is the single most important thing we can do next to pronouncing Yahweh's plan, his name, his proposal. Both those things are important because the only way you're going to get somebody to be receptive, to stop being presumptuous as it relates to coming to know Yahweh, to be sincere in their search, to be open-minded, is to walk away from, to let go of their religious indoctrination. Because it will preclude them from ever coming to know God and ever benefiting from what he has to offer. Moving from the 25th Psalm to the 37th, recognizing that it too was written by the person that Yahweh loved more than anyone in all of human history. It begins, "And then I encourage you to consider acting upon and actively engaging in that which is Tob, good, beneficial, moral, agreeable, generous, and pleasing. And as a result, live forever. That which is good is found in the Torah. That which is pleasing is found in Yahweh's enduring testimony. Yahweh is good. His Torah is good. His covenant is good. Dode is saying, I encourage you to do what I've done. To consider acting upon and actively engaging in that which is good. And as a result, live forever. You know, there's a constant reminder in the eyewitness and hearsay accounts that purports to describe Yahusha's words and deeds. And they speak occasionally of, and if you read it in English, you'll see of sharing the gospel. But that's not in the text. First of all, Yahusha did not speak Greek, which in the Greek word is euangelion. The Greek word is a compound word of you, meaning, which is a translation of the Hebrew tob, good, pleasing, generous, beneficial, and angelos, which means messenger and message. And so Yahusha was actually saying what Dode wrote here, that if you pay attention to that which is good, moral, and agreeable, if you share that which is pleasing and beneficial and generous, you'll live forever. He'll be with you tomorrow.